Good afternoon and welcome to today's special Scottish Parliament Information Centre Brexit Seminar. I'm Joan McAlpine, the convener of the Parliament's Culture, Tourism, Europe and External Affairs Committee, and I'm delighted to chair the seminar today and to welcome Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor, who will provide the Irish and I'm sure the European perspective as well on Brexit negotiations and views and what might happen next. So, as I say, I'm delighted to welcome Tony. He is one of the foremost experts on the Irish aspect of the Brexit negotiations, as would have been apparent to anyone who listened to his session, his evidence session with my committee this morning. Tony is joined the Irish state broadcaster in 1994 as a television and radio reporter, and in 2001 he was appointed the Europe correspondent for RTE, and he was made Europe editor in 2011. He has reported on the UK government's attempts to renegotiate the terms of its EU membership and over the last 2 years on the negotiations, and he must be a candidate for the European Scoop of the Year last year when he beat everyone else make it known that the withdrawal agreement had been signed off and that there was an agreement. His book, Brexit in Ireland, is published by Penguin, and it's described by The Guardian as definitive reading and The Irish Times as absolutely essential. So given the likely impact of Brexit on the Republic of Ireland, Tony's insights will be absolutely fascinating today, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing them. So I won't take up any more of your time, and I'll hand over to Tony. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Joan, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be in Edinburgh. I first came here in a school trip in the 70s, and it hasn't changed a bit, I have to say. But it's great to be here and to help to bring people up to date with the negotiations. And I suppose what I would like to do is to explain how Ireland, which was completely ignored in the referendum, has suddenly become, not suddenly, but eventually became the definitive problem in the Brexit negotiations, which will define and determine the outcome of these negotiations. I can start with a quote from Samuel Beckett, the playwright, when he was asked, are you English? And he said, au contraire. And another anecdote from a French commentator during the Rugby Six Nations, who said, you know, what's the difference between the Irish and the English? And the response was what's the difference between the Irish and British? And the response was, the Irish are not British. And I think identity, unfortunately, goes to the heart of the Brexit crisis that we're in. And it's because it's so bound up with the Good Friday Agreement. So when did Ireland start becoming a problem in the Brexit talks? David Cameron set out in January 2013 this idea of an in-out referendum on EU membership. The next day, the British ambassador to the EU met his Irish counterpart over breakfast, and they went through the speech and underlined a few paragraphs here and there, talked it through, but there was no real alarm. But as the referendum got underway, the Irish government and the Department of Foreign Affairs began to identify potential problems that weren't being identified in the referendum. Anytime the Irish question was brought up in the referendum, people kind of hit the wrong target. They talked about the common travel area between Ireland and the UK and the free movement of people, but nobody ever talked about the free movement of goods and the implications for the Irish border of customs checks and checks on regulatory alignment. So because of the concern and the anxiety that the Irish government had, they began to initially discreetly try and attend the debate in the UK, but then they were pushing protocol to the very limit in the sense that ministers were going over to the UK, the Taoiseach and the Kenny went over quite a few times to try and convince people of the risks to the Good Friday Agreement and the Irish peace process of a leave vote. The trouble was that at the time, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland was Theresa Villiers, who was a very prominent leave campaigner, and she declared unequivocally that there would be no problem at the Irish border in the event of a leave vote. And because she was the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, people actually took her at her word. There was one notable moment in the Irish involvement in the referendum, and that was when Enda Kenny went to London to meet David Cameron, and he went to West London to a Gaelic football match between County Mayo, his county in Ireland, and London. London has a Gaelic football club. And he was being interviewed afterwards, and then a Mayo supporter with a Mayo Gaelic football shirt came up and told an RTE reporter that he was voting leave because he was fed up with foreigners coming over to take British jobs. So that was a slightly off-colour moment for Enda Kenny's campaign in the UK. When the result came in, there had been a very careful coordination at the Irish government level to present its message to the world, because this was an issue of vital national importance for Ireland, and they had choreographed a very elaborate and detailed kind of production that even went down to the detail of where Enda Kenny would stand on the podium in the Irish government buildings in Dublin, where the flags would be. There'd be an EU flag over here, an Irish flag over there, with the very clear message that Ireland is staying in the European Union no matter what. But it was a real shock to Ireland, the result. The Irish embassy had been getting signals in the weeks running up to the referendum that things were not really going well. And of course, when Irish ministers went to the UK, they were talking to Irish clubs and they were trying to do a lot of outreach to the Irish community. The ambassador, Dan Mulhall, was writing op-eds in Irish newspapers. And there was a certain demographic differential. People who were in their 20s or 30s were absolutely pro-Remain. They were attuned to the issue of the Irish peace process. But then there were people who had come to the UK in the 50s and 60s who had probably internalized British attitudes to Europe over time. They would pretty much vote the same way as their neighbors in Birmingham or Liverpool or Manchester or whatever voted. So they were getting worried that the message hadn't got through. And of course, it was then quite a big shock, even though there were inklings within the Irish system that this vote might go down. So the initial instinct after the referendum result was for a bilateral kind of impulse from London and Dublin. The first foreign leader that Theresa May met was Enda Kenny in July of 2016. But already there was a key difference in policy between her and David Cameron. That was when Irish ministers or prime ministers went to Dublin, David Cameron provided three courses at lunch. Theresa May provided two. So therein was the signal for the future. This is going to be a tough ride. So in the autumn then of 2016, there were a lot of bilateral meetings between Ireland and the UK. All of the messaging was very similar. No hard border, no return to the borders of the past, protecting the common travel area, preserving the peace process. But at a certain point, Ireland was starting to wonder, well, how exactly are you going to do that? And then in October 2016, Theresa May made her famous Lancaster House speech, where it was a very hard Brexit speech. Britain would be out of the single market, out of the customs union, forging its way in the world, but yet we were going to preserve the peace process in Ireland. And a senior EU negotiator at the time contacted his British counterparts and said, how are you going to preserve the border in Ireland if you're going to be out of the single market and customs union? And the answer was, we don't know. So this was a clear point of concern for the Irish government. They were getting all these signals about a common goal, a common endeavour to protect the peace process by both Dublin and London, and yet London didn't seem to have the answers as to what was happening and what their final destination would be. And then there was also, at that point, the appointment of Michel Barnier as the EU's chief negotiator, and there was a rather subtle signal sent to Dublin that the Irish border question would have to be negotiated at EU level, not bilaterally between London and Dublin. So as we headed into early January 2017, the Irish government began to crystallise their position on Brexit. Now, everybody was waiting at that time, as you'll remember, for Theresa May to trigger Article 50. And the moment she was going to trigger Article 50, the EU would have to respond with its negotiating guidelines. So it would then give Michel Barnier, their chief negotiator, a mandate handed down from the 27 leaders. I mean, this is a fairly solemn mandate. So the Irish government's objective was to get the Irish issue embedded in those negotiating guidelines, because they were kind of the DNA of the negotiations. So Dublin drew up a draft paragraph that they hoped would be in these negotiating guidelines, sent it to Brussels, the European Council Secretariat sent it back. It's too long. Like any self-respecting student, they moved around some of the paragraphs, sent it back to Brussels, came back again, still too long. But they began between January and April, they began to kind of hone down the key paragraph in the negotiating guidelines that enshrined the Irish issue. Now, you read this paragraph and it sounds quite aspirational, quite, you know, there's a lot of solidarity in there. The EU has always supported the Good Friday Agreement and the Irish peace process, and Brexit poses key challenges. But there are key phrases in there that were fought over for weeks by Irish and EU officials, because there was a natural concern in Brussels not to get too kind of hooked up on the Irish issue. There's a key phrase in there saying that the EU wanted to protect the achievements, benefits and commitments of the Good Friday Agreement. Now that sounds like a kind of piece of rhetoric just for emphasis, but those words were actually fought over. The government officials were calling them the ABCs, achievements, benefits and commitments. And what they were saying was the Good Friday Agreement isn't just a standstill, once-off thing that solves the Irish peace process. It is dynamic. It has the potential to expand, to accommodate the evolving relationships on the island of Ireland and between the island of Ireland and Britain. And those commitments, the word commitments was very important, because it meant, it was referring to things like, you know, how the all-Ireland economy could develop, how cross-border health could develop, how cross-border education could develop. I think this was a really key element of this, because it was a maximalist interpretation of the Good Friday Agreement, and I think that was critical in times to come. Another line in that paragraph was the EU will seek, I think, flexible and imaginative solutions is the key phrase, with the aim of avoiding a hard border on the island of Ireland. Now, with the aim of is not the same as avoiding a hard border. So the EU was signalling in quite a subtle way that they were going to do their best to avoid a hard border, but it was not necessarily a guarantee. In any case, this paragraph was finally agreed, and it was adopted by EU leaders in 4 minutes, the overall negotiating guidelines. They adopted these in 4 minutes at the end of April 2017. So these were the negotiating guidelines. Paragraph 11 was the Irish question. So then the negotiations got underway, and you'll remember in the run-up to those negotiations, the UK government was saying, well, look, the Irish border, of course we all want to solve it, but it is all to do with trade, with customs, with the movement of goods back and forward. That is an issue for the trade negotiations, the future trade relationship. How can it be part of the withdrawal agreement? The Irish government and the EU said essentially, well, yes, you're probably right. We accept that this will be properly fleshed out and realised and conceptualised in the future trade relationship, but we don't actually trust you. Effectively, that was what they were saying, because if we leave it to the next stage of the negotiations, then the Irish border then becomes a bargaining chip to the UK. So you can imagine a scenario where the UK is saying, well, we'd really love to have frictionless trade between the UK and the EU, and we don't really want to be in the customs union and single market. And if you don't give us that frictionless trade, what's going to happen at that lovely Irish border of yours? Not a good situation to be in. So that was why the EU insisted that the border issue was locked into the withdrawal agreement and given legal status. And that was a point of contention all the way along. So then, also at the beginning of the negotiations, the British officials were asked by the European Commission, you talk about preserving North-South cooperation. What exactly do you mean by that? And they were the Commission was prompted by the Irish government on this. And the British side said, well, actually, you're right, we don't fully understand North-South cooperation because it's handled between Dublin and Belfast. But we will go off and we will look at all of the different areas of North-South cooperation. So the British Civil Service and the Northern Ireland Office spent the summer months going through all of the North-South cooperation, and they discovered that there was about 145 areas of North-South cooperation. And they took that, what they called the mapping exercise, to Brussels, and the EU officials and Irish officials and British officials went through all these areas to see where does EU law collide with this cross-border cooperation. And this is very significant because, okay, the Good Friday Agreement doesn't say that there has to be North-South cooperation on health, but North-South cooperation on health emerged because of the conditions created by the Good Friday Agreement. And then they discovered that that North-South cooperation on health involves things like if you're in Donegal and you have a heart attack, then you can go to Alton na Gabhain Hospital in Derry, or if you have a pediatric cancer situation or a heart situation, you can send your child to a special unit in Dublin. But that cooperation could function because both regimes were underpinned by EU law. So ambulance drivers were equally on both sides of the border working under driving conditions that were mandated at EU level. The medical devices they were using were both sanctioned and approved at EU level, and qualifications were approved at EU level. So a lot of this was kind of subtly and implicitly rather than explicitly underpinned by mutual membership of the EU. So all this was feeding into a denouement of August 2017, when Britain was going to have to agree on the Irish issue before it got into the second phase of the negotiations. I'll take you forward then to a key date, November the 8th, 2017. There was an A4 paper drawn up by the EU task force. It was called a working paper, and it was going to be circulated among the member states. Now, they meet in Brussels at a thing called the Working Party. So you've got officials from all the 27 delegations. They meet regularly in Brussels once a week, and they are basically then briefed on how the negotiations are going. So they got this one page about the Irish question. Now, all summer, the British side have been doing this mapping exercise. Whitehall produced these two papers, one on Ireland and Northern Ireland, and the other on customs, when you had this idea of a facilitated customs arrangement. None of these actually found much favour in Brussels. This is one when EU official Sabine Vaillant actually famously said, this is magical thinking on the EU side, sorry, the UK side, that's spawning a whole generation of unicorn references. And the EU's response to those papers, which were quite detailed papers, the EU's response was 5 pages long. They were saying that the Irish question has to be done at the level of principle, and that principle has to govern the solution on the Irish question. So essentially they were saying you need to allow Ireland to abide by its commitments at EU level for on the single market and the customs union, and you also need to abide by the principle of no infrastructure on the Irish border. So out of that process emerged this one-page working paper, and the sixth bullet point on that working paper says words to the effect that it seems essential that in order to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland, in order to preserve the peace process, the all-island economy and the Belfast Agreement, that there be no regulatory divergence on the rules of the single market and the customs union. So that was the embryo of the backstop. They were saying, look, if you want to avoid customs checks, if you want to avoid infrastructure on the Irish border, if you want to preserve all this north-south movement of people and goods and services and healthcare and education, then you can't have a situation where both sides of the island are working under contradictory legal systems. So that was where the backstop began. Now, there was language in there saying if other solutions don't work. So, of course, the British side were saying, hey, we don't need any backstop. The free trade agreement will sort it out, or technology will sort it out. So the response to that from the EU side was, well, they might, but again, we need an insurance policy. So that working paper was explosive for the UK government. They really weren't expecting it. They said, you know, show us where to sign, we'll sign up to the principles paper. Of course, we're going to avoid a hard border, et cetera, et cetera. But the Irish view was, well, there's a kind of an ask here, and this is the ask. You need to start thinking radically about how you solve this problem. And the problem then was that Ollie Robbins, Theresa May's chief negotiator, was saying, we can't have that obstacle on the path for Theresa May to deliver her vision of Brexit. So there were very difficult negotiations in November of that year. There was a famous meeting in Gothenburg between Leo Varadkar and Theresa May, where they were sitting at this tiny table. I mean, their knees must have been touching under the table, and you could sort of feel the tension in the room. And the British side were saying, look, we all want the same outcome, so why can't we sort of sort this out like friends? And the Irish were saying, yes, of course we want the same outcome, but you need a solution that is operable, that works legally. So then Jean-Claude Juncker said, okay, you have a deadline of the 4th of December to sort this out, because at the December Council, we need to decide whether you're moving into phase two of the negotiations or not. And if you don't move into phase two, then you can't get the transition. Businesses were starting to get anxious. So the pressure was on, and there were some key, very difficult negotiations then at the end of November, involving not just the British team and the task force in Brussels, but also Irish officials in the room as well. So they had a certain amount of ownership on this. And again, this reflects the idea that Ireland had outsourced its policy on Brussels, on the Irish border, to Brussels. So any idea that Brussels is playing Ireland to keep Britain in the UK is quite frankly fanciful. But this, at the time of these negotiations, was still very difficult for the British side. They were being asked to sign up to this backstop idea of Northern Ireland staying in the customs union and single market if no other solutions could be found. And these negotiations went right up to the wire. And on the Sunday night before the 4th of December, when this lunch was going to happen with Jean-Claude Juncker and Theresa May, there was a key phone call between Dublin and London. The on the Dublin side was a guy called Martin Fraser, who was the General Secretary of the Irish Government, of the Cabinet, and he was talking to the late Jeremy Haywood on the British side. I met this guy recently, Martin Fraser, in Dingle at a music festival, and he told me, I said, that thing you referred to in your book, that happened here in Dingle. I was in that car park over there on the phone to Jeremy Haywood. And the idea of this phone call was to try and break the deadlock over this, you know, no regulatory divergence between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So what they did was they changed the phrase no regulatory divergence to continued regulatory alignment. What's the difference? I certainly couldn't see it at the time. But there was a very important difference, because no regulatory divergence has a kind of a peremptory sort of instruction to it that you're on this line and you can't diverge from it. Continued regulatory alignment, on the other hand, sounds like it's kind of a voluntary act. You're kind of aligning yourself with EU law at Northern Ireland level. It's been described as train tracks, you know, that we're kind of following you guys, but we're doing it of our own accord kind of thing. But that was essentially the backstop. Now, the 4th of December, I was reporting for RTE in Brussels, and the lunch was about to happen. Nobody knew that this backstop was in the mix at all, because the negotiations were really secret. I'd spent the whole weekend like calling my Irish contacts and British contacts. I was getting nowhere, but I eventually called an EU contact who said, yeah, well, this paper was, yeah, they agreed it on Saturday, but then there's a problem with the Brits and the Irish. And I said, well, what have they agreed? And they said, well, yes, it must be out there. You've surely you've seen it. And I said, well, I haven't seen it. Can you read it out to me? And they said, oh, yeah, okay, fine. So they read out the paragraph saying, in the absence of other solutions, there will be continued. There will be no regulatory divergence on the rules of the single market. And then I found out from a second source that had been changed to continued regulatory alignment. So RTE broke the story that this the UK seemed to have conceded on this point. And at the very moment that I broke the story and put it out on Twitter, the DUP were following my Twitter feed at a meeting in number 9 Downing Street with Julian Smith, the chief whip, and saw this as an obvious piece of spinning by the Irish government because it was coming from RTE. I can say, and I've said before on the record, it was not a brief from the Irish government at all. But when they saw this, they panicked and they walked out, and then Arlene Foster came out and in Stormont and collapsed the process. Theresa May was in the lunch with Jean-Claude Juncker in Brussels, and she got a call saying, we have a problem, and she had to end the lunch and go back to London. It was a very humiliating moment for the British side. Anyway, they came back about a week later. They drummed up what's called paragraph 50, which follows paragraph 49 in the joint report. If you remember, that was the agreement which allowed us to move into phase two. And that paragraph 50 was essentially saying that, okay, we will have this continued regulatory alignment, but there will be no hindrance or there will be unfettered access between Northern Ireland and the UK in terms of trade. Okay, so that seemed to partly pacify the DUP, but not completely. Anyway, that was the joint report. It was agreed. It was signed early in the morning of the 8th of December. And that's exactly what Theresa May has just rejected 3 days ago. So all that effort for the Brady Amendment to come along and overturn that agreement. So what happened after the 8th of December is this joint report was worked up. It was essentially paved the way to move into phase two of the negotiations. The EU Council of that December solemnly accepted the joint report as giving the green light to the next stage. And the 27 leaders instructed the European Commission to produce its first legal text of the withdrawal agreement on the basis of the joint report. So end of February, the Commission duly produced the first draft of the withdrawal agreement with a protocol on Ireland. Now, I spoke to a number of people who were involved in the drafting of this legal text, and they had actually congratulated themselves on quite a dry, neutral legal text that wouldn't cause any problems whatsoever. And I looked at the text and it said, the territory of Northern Ireland will be considered part of the EU customs territory. Now, anybody with half a notion of Irish history knows that you can't use the word territory anywhere. But they had used it in this, the first text. And of course, Theresa May came out into the House of Commons the very same day and said, this is completely unacceptable. No British Prime Minister would ever sign up to it. And that's really what has been the kind of holding pattern ever since. You had a standoff for several months. You had the deadlines coming. June came and went. March came and went. First of all, there was a deadline to try and get the transition sorted in March of last year. The only reason the EU agreed to a transition period was because Theresa May wrote to Donald Tusk saying, yes, we accept the backstop. We accept that there has to be a backstop in Northern Ireland. There may be other solutions, but we accept that the backstop has to be there. So that was waved through. They got the transition agreed at EU 27 level. The next deadline was June, where they had to have this all finished. That came and went. Then October came and went. And then, of course, we had the thing finally signed in November. What changed in between? Well, the UK didn't want to have this Northern Ireland-specific backstop so that Northern Ireland on its own would be kept in the single market and customs union if no other solutions could be found. And of course, the backstop, just to remind people, the backstop is only there if the trade agreement isn't done on time or if the trade agreement doesn't provide the conditions for no infrastructure on the Irish border. So the UK's response to this was, well, why don't we make the backstop all of the UK for customs? So that means you wouldn't have any customs checks on the Irish Sea for goods going from, say, Liverpool to Belfast. You would have all of the UK in a customs union for a temporary period. Now, the EU had reservations about this, firstly because the negotiating guidelines say that these, and the joint reports say that the circumstances on the island of Ireland are unique, so this must only apply to the island of Ireland. So now London was coming along and saying we want a UK-wide solution. Also, they felt Article 50 didn't really provide the right legal basis for this. But eventually, as we get into September and October and the deadline was looming, eventually the EU moved. Now, they moved, but not without a precondition. So Article 50 is really designed for three things. One is to have an orderly disentanglement of UK membership. Secondly, to resolve the abiding commitments of the UK. Now, those are really two things. One is citizens' rights, because there's a kind of a moral obligation on the UK to look after the rights of citizens that they've welcomed into their country as part of EU membership. And the second abiding commitment is the Good Friday Agreement. Now, the third element of the understanding of what Article 50 is for is that it must provide a bridge to the future negotiations. And that's kind of spelled out in Article 50. So at a certain point, the EU was saying, OK, we don't like this idea of a UK-wide customs union. It's one thing to have a customs arrangement for Northern Ireland. It's a tiny little place. But the UK is the world's fifth biggest economy. And you want to have a customs union with the EU that's kind of temporary, and it has to fit into this withdrawal agreement, which is really the divorce. It's not the future relationship. If we're going to do that, we need to make sure that the third part of Article 50, the bridge to the future relationship, that has to mean something. So we're prepared to do this if you, the United Kingdom, accept that this is the basis for, or a basis for, the future relationship. So that is why Brexiteers hate this so much, because it kind of, the backstop and the UK-wide customs union kind of define the future relationship because of this bridge idea. Now, as far as I understand it, the Article 50 task force made it very clear to the UK side, is this what you want? Are you prepared to accept this? And the answer was yes, we need to accept this because we need to get this over the line. The other kind of flip side of this idea of a UK-wide customs union was that it was giving the UK customs and tariff-free access to the EU for not much in return. So we got this response of that dealt with what they call level playing field issues. So the EU 27 were going, hang on a second, if you're going to get access to our market, we need some guarantees or assurance that you're not going to undercut us on environmental standards, on labour standards, on social legislation, and so on. So they had to start baking in a whole set of conditions to this UK-wide customs thing in the withdrawal agreement. They also wanted, of course, fish, which I know is a very important issue in Scotland. They wanted to make sure that fisheries would also be a kind of prerequisite to get some guarantee that EU vessels would still be able to access British waters, including Scottish waters, obviously. Incidentally, the most valuable catch for the Irish fleet is mackerel, and they catch it in Scotland, in Scottish waters, just to let you know. So this was then starting to get very complicated, and I think because the other member states were starting to kick back on this UK-wide customs union, I think the British side thought, okay, we better grab this while we have it, because otherwise they're going to start to be pushing for more concessions. So on the 13th of November, rather the night before, the 12th of November, late at night, they stabilised the text. And actually, RT, it was another scoop that we had. We broke the story the next day to say that the text had been agreed. Jacob Rees-Mogg was very upset that they hadn't given it to a British broadcaster. They'd given it as if it's kind of given to an Irish broadcaster. But there you are. So that's really where things stand. So now what's happened is that the Brady Amendment means that Theresa May has essentially rejected the document that she spent 2 years negotiating, and they're now back looking at either a unilateral exit from the backstop, a time limit to the backstop, or technology as a solution. And I can talk about technology in the Q&A session, but this is the kind of bizarre situation where we are at the moment. Having gone through that whole grueling, exhausting process over 2 years, all of the meetings and the agony and the ecstasy over the backstop and how to preserve the Good Friday Agreement and avoid hard borders and so on, that has been overturned by a single vote in the House of Commons. And that's where we're at. So I'll leave it there and can take questions.
Okay, thanks very much, Tony. That was absolutely fascinating.